says, well, what do you have in mind? Adam said, well, Lord, he says, I wish you'd create for me a beautiful woman. A beautiful woman who'd love me tenderly. She could sing beautifully, cook delicious meals, wait on me hand and foot, and never complain about anything. Well, the Lord said, yes, I could create somebody like that for you, but it's going to cost you an arm and a leg. Well, Adam thought about that for a while and finally said, Lord, what can I get for a rib? Well, all right. Come on, all you guys that are clapping. Let's admit it. Come on now, let's confess. We really did get something great for that rib, didn't we? Amen. But I always will wonder what we could have got for that arm and a leg. The subject of origins, certainly as I've described this morning, is very, very important. And we want to get into the fossil record a bit tonight and some other evidence. But I want to mention, you know, we are told, here's what the evolutionists will say. He'll say this, well, we are confined by science to natural processes. We can't bring in the supernatural. It's not science. Well, now, it's true. As scientists, when we try to observe and understand and explain the operation of the universe and the operation of living things, we are restricted the use of natural laws and natural processes. That's the only way a scientist can operate. But the evolutionist goes beyond that. He steps outside of the limits of empirical science. He says we must not only use those natural laws and processes to explain the operation of the universe and the operation of living things, but we must use those very same natural laws and processes to explain the origin of the universe and the origin of life and the origin of all living things. Now, you see, he is beyond empirical science, as I described this morning. There's no human witness to the origin of the universe, the origin of life, the origin of any living thing. You see, science, now scientific theories, and I want to distinguish between what we call science and what we call scientific theories. Now, scientific theory must be based upon observations that are repeatable. You must be able to repeatedly observe the process. So anyone can test your theory. You see, if it's a scientific theory, it must be based on repeatable observations so you can test your theory. Now, that cannot be done with origins, whether it's creation or evolution. Now, of course, evolution and creation have scientific characteristics, and we can discuss them in scientific terms, as we have been doing today. But they're not scientific theories. Therefore, to say that we are restricted to using evolution theory in our public schools, we can't bring in creation because that brings in a creator. That's religion. No. No more religious than evolution, which is no creator, you see. But that's the weapon they use against the creationists at all times. Now, you've all heard a lot about this big flap in Kansas. What did they do in Kansas? They opened the door, a little crack, just a little crack to creation. They de-emphasized evolution. They didn't prohibit the teaching of evolution. They didn't say creation had to be taught. Merely de-emphasized evolution. And the whole evolutionary world is in an uproar all over the United States. This is on the front pages of all the newspapers. And there were just all kinds of television and radio stories about it. I appeared on CNN 3 times about this issue, debating or discussing this issue with evolutionists. But it's sort of strange, the last time I appeared on CNN, I alerted my relatives here in California to watch that program. They didn't see anything. Nothing came in California in that program. The next day, I got an email from the pastor's wife in Sao Paulo, Brazil, where we had visited several times. She had seen it on CNN down there. And then the couple, 3 days later, I got an email from my friends in Istanbul, Muslim friends. They had seen it over there in Istanbul on television. But my own relatives here in California didn't get to see it. But, you see, as I discuss in my book, Teaching Creation Science in Public Schools, we can teach creation in public schools. I see this in the newspaper all the time. The Supreme Court said you cannot teach creation in public schools. That is absolutely false. They did not rule that at all. You can do it legally and constitutionally. And furthermore, when they mention this issue, they say, oh, it's biblical creation versus evolution. No, it's not biblical creation. Unfortunately, we cannot go in the public schools with the Bible. We can't go in there with the book of Genesis. We can't teach that. No, we're not trying to do that. We know we can't do it. The Supreme Court says we can't. What we're trying to do is introduce the scientific evidence that challenges the theory of evolution, shows its weaknesses and fallacies, and the scientific evidence that supports a theistic supernatural creation. That's what we're trying to do. But the mass media, you know, they're not on our side at all. The fact is, evolutionists control our educational system. They control our scientific establishment. You know, it's almost impossible to get an article in one of our science journals supporting the creation side. Some years ago, Stephen Jay Gould, famous evolutionist at Harvard University, published an article in the journal Discover, and he supporting creationists, and he criticized the creationists, including me personally. So I asked the editor, I said, I would like to write an article of equal length in reply to this article by Gould. Will you publish it? He said, no, we won't. He says, however, I will allow you to write a one-page letter to the editor, which I did. That's the extent of it. Another leading science journal, I was talking to the editor, and I asked her, I says, I would like to submit an article supporting a creation position. Will you publish it? She said, no, we won't. And that's the situation. You know, then the evolutionists turn around and say, you guys don't publish in our leading journals. Why don't you publish in our leading journals? Because you've got to get that article past the editor and three referees. And one referee turns it down, it never gets published, and that's the problem. We could just get our case in there. Oh, if we had the access to the mass media, the newspapers, San Diego Tribune. Do you know Union Tribune? I have submitted repeated articles to that newspaper, and they won't publish them. And they publish all kinds of editorials and articles by other people against the creationists, naming us and the Institute for Creation Research, and we can't even get a reply. I mean, a reasonable scientific answer to that sort of thing. And that is what we're up against. And, you know, it's an amazing thing how different it is here in the United States compared to Russia. I'll be going back to Russia for my fifth visit in March. My last visit there, we met with three officials of the Ministry of Education. You know what they told us? They said they had three objectives in their school. They wanted to teach alternatives, no more indoctrination. They wanted to teach alternatives, including creation. And I'm writing a book. They want me to submit a book for use in their schools on teaching creation science. They wanted to teach alternatives. They said that they wanted to restore a moral and ethical code into their schools, and they wanted to restore the students to their parents. What are we doing in this country? Brainwashing. No alternative to creation, no to origin, no alternative to evolution, just indoctrination. They're stripping almost every vestige, certainly, of any Christian influence out of our public schools. Moral and ethical codes are out. And they want to take the children, just as young as they can, from the parents and put them under control of the state. Just the opposite of what's going on in Russia today, this so-called Christian nation of ours. Well, evolutionists tell us that some billions of years ago, life evolved on this planet from non-life. Now, I mentioned already that I could give 50 reasons why that's impossible. It was interesting that several years ago, actually some years ago, 1981, there's an article published about a couple of British scientists. One was Sir Fred Hoyle, very famous British astronomer, well known throughout the world. Some people believe he should have got the Nobel Prize. The other scientist was Professor Chandrawick Ramasinghe, who was head of the Department of Applied Mathematics and Astronomy at the University College in Cardiff, Wales. They were collaborating, and what they did was this. They got interested in the problem of the origin of life. They began by making certain assumptions about the minimum requirement to get life started. What would you have to initiate life? And then they assumed that every star in the entire universe had a planet like the Earth. There'd be an awful lot of planets. And then they assumed that the universe was 20 billion years old. Then they calculated. Now, using these assumptions then, they calculated the probability of life evolving anywhere in the universe in that 20 billion years. Their results astounded these two scientists. According to their calculations, the probability of an evolutionary origin of life anywhere in the universe in that 20 billion years was essentially nil. Sir Fred said the probability of an evolutionary origin of life is equal to the probability that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard would assemble a Boeing 747. Well, these two scientists rightly concluded that was impossible. So they said a naturalistic evolutionary origin of life is just impossible. They said, well, there's only one other possibility. It had to be created supernaturally. Therefore, there must be a God. Now, I'd like to show a slide with this newspaper as appeared in London with that big headline. Two skeptical scientists put their heads together and reached an amazing conclusion. Big black letters. There must be a God. Now, these scientists did not reach that conclusion because of their religion, because they were both atheists when they began these studies. They reached that conclusion in spite of their religion. They reached that conclusion because of the hard facts of science. Of course, this was a conclusion I had reached many, many years earlier through my studies of biochemistry and the problem of origin of life. Well, anyhow, here's life, they said, this little microscopic organism. Now, nothing much happened for 3 billion years, they believe, just these microscopic organisms. Then there was a sort of an explosion, and very complex invertebrates, the fossils of these things are found. Clams and snails and jellyfish and worms and brachiopods and trilobites and things like that, and I'll show a slide shortly illustrating some of these things. The fossils of these creatures are found in rock, sort of an explosion. Here they are. And then they believe, this was many, many millions of years ago, of course. And then one of these invertebrates, one or more, evolved into fishes. Vertebrates. They're vertebrates like you and me. They have an internal skeleton. So we went from an invertebrate to a vertebrate. And then the fishes evolved into amphibians. That means the fins of the fish had to change, and the feet and legs of the amphibians, and many other changes had to take place, of course. Then the amphibians evolved into reptiles. That would require a tremendous change in physiology and mode of reproduction and so forth. And then a reptile evolved into a bird. Well, that means the feet and legs of the reptile had to change in the wings, and scales had to change in the feathers, and the mode of reproduction was enormously different, and the breathing apparatus was enormously different. And then they also believe that reptiles evolved into mammals. Well, a great difference between mammals and reptiles, of course. And the lower mammals, they evolved up into people. So we have this evolutionary process that started billions of years ago. During this time, over hundreds of millions of years, millions of species has evolved by this evolutionary process. Now you see, if that's really true, we would expect and predict it. We'd find many, many transitional forms. Our museums have 250,000 different fossil species. If evolution is true, tens of thousands of those species, fossil species, should be of transitional form, showing these changes taking place. During millions of years of time, one kind became a different kind. We'd have no problem whatsoever validating the theory of evolution. We'd have abundant evidence of that. On the other hand, if creation is true, we'd expect something very different, wouldn't we? Each kind appeared fully formed. Cats were always cats. Dogs were always dogs. And you know, today you cannot cross a dog with a cat and get a dat. Have you ever seen a dat? I've never seen a dat. No, they are distinct kinds, you see. And we have all of these various distinct kinds. And we maintain, when we look at the fossil record, they have always been separate and distinct, as we would expect. That's what we must find. You see, that is what that's the evidence we predict. No transitional forms, no ancestors for each created kind. Now, variation within kind. Yes, many races of people. Many different varieties of finches that Darwin saw when he went to the Galapagos Islands. You know, they show students all these various kinds of finches. There's about 26 islands there in the Galapagos Islands, about 800 miles off the west coast of South America. And you go from island to island, you find various species, they call them, different species of these finches. They vary in the size and shape of the beak. Consequently, they eat different kind of food. Well, as a matter of fact, these finches interbreed with one another and produce fertile offspring. Now, by any definition of a species, then, they should be subspecies, not species. There is one species, and these varieties are just subspecies. As the creation scientists point out, these birds are not only still birds, they're still finches. You see, what evolution has to explain, or creation has to explain. It's a variation. We believe in variation. We believe in adaptation and all of that. We believe in that. But finches have always been finches. You see, Darwin saw this evidence for limited variation. Then he made a great leap of faith. He assumed that finches and canaries and ducks and eagles and hummingbirds had all evolved from a common ancestor, which in turn had evolved from a reptile. That, you see, is the evidence that we do not find. We maintain that it's clear. Now, I mentioned a little bit about the mechanism based upon mutations and natural selection. You know, the majority of scientists came over to Darwin's side when he came out with his book, The Origin of Species, because they believed that he had supplied a reasonable mechanism. Now, Darwin had explained how evolution could take place. Of course, he didn't know anything about mutations. He just knew there was variation. But he suggested this idea of natural selection. Natural selection is just what it means is this, that some creatures reproduce in larger numbers than others, and so eventually they replace them. That's what they mean by natural selection. And that has been accepted and is still taught through most of our universities, almost all of our universities today, this idea of the gradual evolutionary change as Darwin suggested. Now, there are some scientists who don't believe that. You know, we're nearly 150 years after Darwin, and if that theory was that good and is true, it should be solid by this time. All these many, many years and years of research and study and everything, everybody, all evolution should believe this theory, but they don't. More and more evolutionists are turning against Darwinism and saying that mutations and natural selection could not possibly produce what we have today. It can cause variations within each type, each basic kind, but could never produce something new, breathing, photosynthesis, and things like that. And they have various ideas how that may have been accomplished. One extreme idea is called the hopeful monster mechanism. There are a few scientists who say, now look, the major kinds, what scientists call phyla, classes, orders, and families, and so forth, they all appear fully formed, and there are no transitional forms. There are no transitional forms in the fossil record because there never were any transitional forms. Therefore, there must have been big jumps in evolution. They call it the hopeful monster mechanism. They believe, for example, that a reptile laid an egg and a bird was hatched from the egg. Just like that, you went from a reptile to a bird. Must have been a tremendous shock to Mama Reptile when that happened. I think she would have given up motherhood. But this is what they suggest. One of these scientists, a scientist called Soren Lovtrup, he's a Swedish scientist. Dr. Lovtrup is known throughout the world for his work in biology. I heard him speak a number of years ago. Both he and I had been invited to Jerusalem, to Hebrew University, to participate in what they call the first annual conference on origins and evolution. Both creation scientists and evolution scientists had been invited. When I heard Dr. Lovtrup speak, I knew immediately he was not a Darwinian. He certainly is an evolutionist. But he does not believe that mutations and natural selection had anything to do with evolution. In 1987, he published a book entitled Darwinism, The Refutation of a Myth. Now, in that book, Dr. Lovtrup describes Darwinism, all about Darwinism from the beginning up to the present time, and he describes the modern Darwinian theory. He tells us why he cannot accept it, why he rejects that theory. Then he describes his own ideas about evolution. And then in one of the closing passages in the book, he makes a very significant statement. Now maybe we have that first slide. We see that on the first slide. Now we can turn out these lights up here. This Swedish science. Now remember, now what he calls the Darwinian myth is what is being taught in our universities in the United States as established fact and throughout most universities in the world. That's what he calls the Darwinian myth. He says, I believe that one day the Darwinian myth will be ranked the greatest deceit in the history of science. Now, ladies and gentlemen, just think about that for a moment. What this evolutionist calls the greatest deceit in the history of science is what is being taught in our colleges and universities as established truth. And in most of our schools. That's what is taught in our schools in the state of California. As established truth. This evolutionist says is the greatest deceit in the history of science. Now, of course, he's referring to the mechanism of evolution that is being taught. Well, we creation scientists, we would agree with Dr. Lovetrup that this Darwinian myth is the greatest deceit in the history of science. We go, of course, one step farther than that. We say that is not only the greatest deceit in the history of science, but the very notion of evolution is the greatest deceit in the history of science. Now, we're not saying that evolutionists are deliberately deceitful or dishonest. That's not what we're saying. What we are saying, they have been deceived or have deceived themselves into accepting something that is totally wrong. Well, now let's take a look at some of the major features of the fossil record. Next slide, please. Here's a reconstruction of those creatures whose fossils are found in Cambrian rocks. Now, what's a Cambrian rock? Well, a Cambrian rock is a rock that contains certain kinds of fossils. Fossils of trilobites, certain brachiopods, and so forth. The evolution says that is a Cambrian rock. They say these rocks began to form about 520 million years ago. You know, it's strange. About 20 and 30 years ago, they dated these rocks repeatedly, and they said they began to form 600 million years ago. Now they're telling us that they began to form 520 million years ago. Somehow they've lost 80 million years. But what's 80 million years among friends? But anyhow, of course, we don't. I will say this. Members of our institute, members of the Creation Research Society, which now has over 600 members and thousands of other creation scientists, do not believe in these millions and billions of years. Now, there are many creationists who do. They are creationists, but they accept the old age for the earth. We believe there's much evidence for the young age. But regardless, whenever these things appeared, there they are. We have their fossils. And they include fossils of sponges, fossils of jellyfish, fossils of trilobites and sea urchins and sea lilies, and fossils of clams and snails and brachiopods and worms and things like that. Now, these are complex invertebrates. We find billions times billions of their fossils in the rocks, probably times billions again. Now, underneath these Cambrian rocks are what are called Precambrian rocks. Now, evolutionists believe the Precambrian rocks, which generally underlie the Cambrian, that they believe that these rocks formed during millions of years, hundreds of millions of years, preceding and leading up to the Cambrian. Now, if evolution is true, what must we find in those Precambrian rocks? Obviously, we must find the evolutionary ancestors of these complex invertebrates, quite obviously. And they ought to be there in billions, times billions, times billions of those things. There'd be no problem whatsoever in finding their fossils. They're very complex. Next slide, please. Here's the fossil trilobite. Greatly enlarged, of course. But very complex creature. The next slide shows the eye of the trilobite. Next slide, please. The eye of the trilobite has about 600 limbs. Now, scientists were able to study the optics of these eyes because the lens of the trilobite, not like our lens, the lens of the trilobite is composed of inorganic crystalline calcium carbonate. So the lens are still there. They're able to study the optics of these eyes. And you know, they were astounded to discover the trilobite had perfect, undistorted vision. He had utilized several principles and laws of optics to construct a perfect eye free of distortion. Underwater, you must have a double lens to avoid distortion. Every one of those lenses is a double lens. And the trilobite doesn't even need eyes. There are some trilobites that didn't have eyes. But when that trilobite appears in the fossil record, he is complete, perfect eyes and all. There's not a trace of an ancestor ever been found on the face of this earth. No ancestors for clams and snails and worms and brachiopods and sponges and all those things. They all appear fully formed. Let us see what an evolutionist has to say about that. You see, I tell people, you don't have to accept what a creationist says. Let's see what an evolutionist says. Douglas Fatuma, an evolutionist. In fact, he wrote an anti-creationist book. You see, now, let me explain those. A trilobite and a sponge and worms, and they are so vastly different from one another. They've been placed in separate phyla. That's the broadest taxonomy. Taxonomic unit is the phylum. And very inclusive. They include all of a certain basic type in the phyla. Let's see what he has to say. Next slide, please. In his book, Evolutionary Biology, second edition, published in 1986, he says this: it is considered likely that all the animal phyla became distinct before or during the Cambrian, for they all appear fully formed, without intermediates connecting one phylum to another. End of quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, evolution is dead right at the very start. What does he say? Every one of these basic types appear fully formed. No ancestor, not a trace. What does he say further? Supposedly, of course, they all evolved from a common ancestor. What does he say? There are no transitional forms linking one phylum to another. That cannot be true if evolution is true. You can't have discontinuities like that. You've got to have continuity. Right at the very start, there's an explosive appearance of these very complex invertebrates, no trace of ancestors, no trace of any connecting form. That absolutely destroys the theory of evolution. Evolution cannot be true. Everything on the face of the earth, that is all animals supposedly evolved from one of these invertebrates. Now, of course, evolutionists believe that one of these invertebrates evolved into the fishes. Where else would fishes have come from? Now, we have billions times billions of these fossils of these invertebrates. Next slide. And we have billions and billions of fossil fishes. Now, some evolutionists believe it took about 100 million years for an invertebrate to evolve into a fish. Well, if that's true, we ought to find billions times billions of fossils of the transitional form, the many intermediate stages. You see, during these many, many millions of years, what an incredible thing to change a worm into a fish or a clam into a fish or whatever. That'd be an incredible transformation. And you have to have all kinds of intermediate stages. We ought to have billions times billions of those fossils. You know what? We don't even have one. Why, museums should have millions and millions of those things, and they don't have any. Every major kind of fish that we know anything about appears in the fossil record complete without a trace of an ancestor and no connecting form between these major kind of fishes. Now, that cannot be true, and evolution be true. When I debate evolutionists, I challenge them with this evidence. I say, would you please explain to this audience how an invertebrate can evolve into a fish during these many, many millions of years and not leave a trace? They don't say a word. They talk about something else. Why don't they? Because they don't have anything to say. Now, evolutionists know this. They say this in their evolutionary literature. They admit that this is true. A man named Strahler wrote a big anti-creationist book, and he was critiquing my books on the fossil record. And he says, Gish is right. He said, when he says there are no ancestors for fishes and no intermediate forms, he searched the literature. He said, it's right. But why is he still an evolutionist? He's an evolutionist not because of the evidence, in spite of the evidence. You see, this cannot be true. Cannot be true. All the vertebrates, you and me, suppose that we evolved from fishes. But they didn't have any ancestors, so we didn't either. You know, this old fable that Human embryo has gill slits. Therefore, that's proof we came from fishes. Do you know that's a thoroughly discredited theory? Knowledgeable evolutionists, embryologists know that there's no so-called recapitulation and during the development of the embryo, it doesn't look like a fish and then a tadpole and so forth and so on. It's a thoroughly discredited theory, but it's still taught in our textbook. Still found in many, many textbooks. Thoroughly discredited theory. A number of years ago, I was debating Ashley Montague at Princeton University, very famous evolutionist. I made that statement, and he said this. He says, yes, he says, that's true. And no evolutionist should ever use that discredited theory to support evolution. And they use it all the time. Well, here again, you see, it's absolutely solid, irrefutable evidence that evolution has not taken place on this planet. We could just close out the lecture right now. Ladies and gentlemen, what's the use talking about anything else? I know you don't want me to do that. So we'll go ahead. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. We want to talk about some of the dinosaurs. Now, dinosaurs are really a marvelous testimony for creation. Do you know we find fossils of dinosaurs on every continent of the world? Fossils of dinosaurs have been found on the north shore of Alaska above the Arctic Circle. They've been found in Antarctica, all over the world. Some were small as chickens. Some, as we'll see, weighed up to 200,000 pounds. All sizes and shapes, descriptions of these things. We just have their fossils. But using those fossils, we can reconstruct what these things look like in some cases. In some cases, we have what's a complete fossil of a dinosaur. Sometimes we only have part of it, so you have to do a lot of guessing. But we can get a pretty good idea of what many of these dinosaurs look like. Now, you see, evolutionists believe that dinosaurs were on this earth for 160, 180 million years. If that were true, all these things were evolving during all that vast stretch of time, why, our museum should have dozens and dozens and dozens of fossils of transitional form showing the unique structures on dinosaurs gradually coming into existence. Well, by the way, how do you tell a dinosaur from a reptile? Well, the legs of a dinosaur are directly underneath the body. Some of them were bipedal. Some were quadrupedal. But their legs are directly underneath the body. A reptile has a, kind of wide gait, awkward gait. But the dinosaurs were very, very good walkers or runners because their legs are directly under the body. Now, here we see a reconstruction of a dinosaur called Triceratops. Triceratops means three-horned face. Triceratops had three horns, one above each eye and one in the snout. Weighed about 8 to 10 tons. Had that huge bony armor plate. I think he'd be a pretty good match for a Tyrannosaurus Rex. There were different kinds of horned dinosaurs. We had the Triceratops as a one-horned dinosaur, Monoclonius, and then the Styracosaurus, the next slide, was a multi-horned dinosaur. He had a huge horn in the snout and these horns around the fringe. Now, you see, if these creatures evolved, then we should find fossils with in initial fossils to show little knobbies there where the horns are. And then after, say, 500,000 years, it might be an inch long. And then after a million and a half, 2 million years, it might be 2 or 3 inches long. And after some millions of years, you'd have a complete horn. So you'd have a series of intermediate transitional forms. If evolution is true, we don't have any. All of these things appear fully formed, just as we would expect on the basis of creation. And next slide. Then we have Stegosaurus. Notice the Stegosaurus had no horns on the head, but it had those spikes on the tail and these plates that run along the neck, the back, and the tail. Next slide, please. And we see that these spikes were very substantial, about 3 feet long, as were these plates. Now, the evolutionists would believe that in the beginning, you see, those spikes might have been about that long, and they got longer and longer and longer and longer and longer through millions of years of time. And these plates, we don't know what purpose they served. Maybe they were heat exchangers. We just don't know. But whatever purpose they served, they had to evolve from something. It had to be gradual. Couldn't just happen overnight. So we ought to have transitional forms. You know, we have none. No transitional forms whatsoever. Stegosaurus is just Stegosaurus right at the beginning. No apologies. Next slide, please. And we have the duck-billed dinosaurs. This is Trachodon, standing about 18 feet high. It had a huge duck bill. In the next slide, we see the duck bill of this creature. Now, what evolutionists believe, the duck-billed dinosaurs, obviously, they believe that some dinosaur or a reptile, the jaws and teeth gradually change into a duck bill. What the critter was eating during that time, I don't know. But they believe that that must have happened. Well, we ought to have all kinds of transitional forms. There are many different kinds of duck-billed dinosaurs. The next slide, please. We see Corythosaurus. It was a duck bill. Notice that the duck bills did have teeth in the back of their duck bill. Look at that bony dome on the top of this dinosaur. Do you know that bony dome was 9 inches thick? You talk about an old bonehead, he was it. He bit the foot of the class. Might make a fine tackle on your football team, though. The next slide shows Parasaurolophus, another duck bill. Notice that odd structure. Now, if these duck bills evolve, we should have many transitional forms showing duck bills gradually evolving from ordinary jaws and teeth, and these odd structures evolving. Not one such transitional form has ever been found. Next slide. And this next... How'd that slide get in there? That's not a dinosaur. I didn't intend to show that slide at all, ladies and gentlemen. That's a picture of my grandson. Well, my wife and I are real proud of that little fellow. He's a cute little fellow. Already knows his ABCs. Next slide. Well, back to dinosaurs. Now, every child here could tell us what this dinosaur is. I bet you could, couldn't you? Say it louder. That's right. See, I knew it. Tyrannosaurus Rex. That's Tyrannosaurus Rex. Yep. I bet you could have told us too, couldn't you? You bet. Well, the jaws were about 6 feet long, up to 6 feet long. The teeth were about 6 inches long. Now, he's supposed to have been a meat eater. We really don't know what he ate. He seemed to be equipped for it. I imagine he did. But we weren't there to see what he did eat. Gorillas have some fierce-looking teeth. The next time you get to a zoo, and get real close, nose-to-nose with a gorilla, and look at his teeth. They look like he ate meat. Gorillas don't eat meat. They're herbivores. And other animals. Fruit-eating bats have some fierce-looking teeth. They just eat fruit. And the panda, of course, he has some real sharp teeth. Looks like he could eat meat. He just eats bamboo. So we don't know what they ate. You know, the Bible tells us, in the beginning, all creatures were created to eat plants and vegetation and fruit and so forth. And what I think must have happened, when man sinned and rebelled against God, and sin came in the world, rebellion, I think these animals that probably hungered for it and wanted to do it and had the equipment for it began to eat meat. And certainly humans ate meat before the flood. The Bible tells us that after the flood, God said, now it is okay to eat meat. Apparently because of tremendous change conditions that took place at that time. It was all right. But, of course, people were eating meat before that time. They didn't care what God thought about it. I think that's probably what happened. And those animals that were equipped with defense mechanisms, I believe God knew what was going to happen. He knew man was going to sin. He knew death was going to come in the world. And I think he equipped these creatures with the defense mechanisms ready for their survival. But in any case, we believe these things were meat eaters, and different kinds of meat eaters, dinosaurs, many different kinds. And then we had the great plant eaters. The next slide. This is Diplodocus. Look at the man standing in front of this 100-foot-long dinosaur. The name Diplodocus means double-beamed. Well, I guess he was double-beamed, wasn't he? The next slide shows what he may have looked like on some ancient shore. Next slide, please. Great, huge dinosaur. Not the biggest dinosaur by any means. The next slide. We see the great Brontosaurus. Brontosaurus means thunder lizard. This dinosaur weighed about 40 tons, about 80,000 pounds, about 80 feet long. And the scientist who discovered this dinosaur believe the ground must have thundered when he went by, so he named him Brontosaurus, which means thunder lizard. Now, I won't go into details, but we're not supposed to call him Brontosaurus anymore. We're supposed to call him Apatosaurus. Apparently, somebody thought that they got the wrong skull on it and they misnamed it and so forth and so on. So we're supposed to call him Apatosaurus. But, you know, several years ago, well, in 1989 it was, the U.S. government published a series of stamps. On those stamps was a picture of this dinosaur. What do you think they called him? Brontosaurus. Well, if the U.S. government can call him Brontosaurus, so can I. I like that much better than Apatosaurus. Next slide, we see one of the largest dinosaurs of all, the great Brachiosaurus. Brachiosaurus weighed up to 100 tons, or 200,000 pounds. He stood as high as a five-story building, 50 feet high. One of these great plant-eating dinosaurs. And he had a very strange anatomy. His nostrils were not located out on the end of the snout, as is the case with all other self-respecting dinosaurs, but located in that bony dome on the top of the head. Now, nobody has ever been able to figure out why he had that strange arrangement. The evolutionists will say, well, we don't know why he had an anatomy like that, but it must have been important, or he never would have evolved that way. The creationists say, well, we don't know why he had that strange arrangement, but obviously it was important, or God would never have made him that way. So at least on that point, the creationists and the evolutionists agree. We don't know why he had that strange arrangement. Now, you can make suggestions, but none of them seem to be compelling. But this is one thing we do know. We've never found any intermediates, transitional form, showing the nostrils migrating from the snout into the bony dome on the top of the head. All brachiosauruses, right from the very start, were just that way. No intermediates, no transitional form. And you know that's true throughout this entire world of dinosaurs. I have a book called The Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs. In that book, the authors listed every fossil dinosaur which they were aware of. You know what I did, don't you? I leafed through that book. I went all through that book to see if they could describe any examples of transitional forms. And you know what? They couldn't describe one. They had none whatsoever. I've been to London a number of times, and every time I go to London, that is almost every time, I visit the British Museum of Natural History. One of my visits to London, they had a tremendous exhibit of dinosaurs at the British Museum. Very, very popular exhibit, of course. In this huge exhibition hall were fossils of dinosaurs from all over the world. Again, you know what I did. I went through that entire exhibit to see if I could find examples of transitional forms, even one. You know what? There wasn't one. Nowhere in that entire exhibit was a single example of a transitional form. And you know that if those scientists at the British Museum of Natural History, if they had been aware of anything like that, it'd be right there. It'd be the star of the exhibit, the spotlight on it, and all the directions to us to go and see this incredible evidence for evolution. They didn't even have one. How can it be? We had these creatures on this earth, they believe, for 160 to 180 million years, where all these things were evolving, and we can't find any transitional form. Dig up dinosaurs, you find duck-billed dinosaurs, you find horned dinosaurs, you find plated dinosaurs, you find stegosaurians, and so forth and so on, but you don't find any transitional form. Not one. Now, why? Well, I think the answer is very plain. Because none ever existed. They were dinosaurs from the very beginning. Why did God create dinosaurs? I don't know. I would suggest this, possibly. God delighted in His creation. All the different things that He created. Look at the creatures of the sea. And just almost unlimited different kinds of creatures in the sea. Some are beautiful and some are not so beautiful. All these things, God just delighted in His creation. Now, when I get to heaven, I'm a lot closer to heaven than a lot of you younger people. But I always tell young people, getting old is not all bad. In the first place, what's the only alternative? You have to die young. See, then you don't get old. And secondly, when you get to be a senior citizen, you get all those discounts and airlines and restaurants. And oh, man, I tell you, young people can hardly wait to get out of here and become senior citizens. You get all those discounts. Well, so we had these things. Now I lost my track of my thinking here. Got off track here. But let me get back on track. Why don't we find the word dinosaur in the Bible? Well, the answer is very simple. Dinosaur fossils were not discovered until about 1820. The fact is, the word dinosaur was not even invented until 1840. But the Bible was translated into English in about 1600, more than 200 years earlier. Of course, we don't find the word dinosaur in the Bible. But I believe we find a description of dinosaurs in the Bible. In the book of Job, chapter 40, beginning at verse 15, we read about a creature called a behemoth. The Bible tells us he was a huge creature. He was so big, he just thought he could drink up a river. Wouldn't even have to be in a hurry about it. And he had bones like bars of iron. And he had a tail like a cedar tree. Now, some have suggested the Bible was describing an elephant. Have you ever seen a tail of an elephant? Doesn't look like a cedar tree, does it? No animal that I know of on the face of the earth had a tail that looked like a cedar tree. But that seemed to be a perfect description of dinosaurs. And if so, that means somebody had seen dinosaurs and were able to describe them. Job chapter 41, we read about a leviathan that breathes fire. I believe the Bible is literally describing a creature that breathes fire. And that would be some of the so-called serpents or whatever, you know, that they choose to call those things. Fact is, when one of our trips to Israel, we went over to Jordan, and we visited the Church of St. George. And on the wall there was a huge picture of St. George killing a dragon. And that was why he was sainted, because he gave credit and honor to Christ for this great victory. Anyhow, the Bible describes something that breathes fire. You know, I believe it's literal. In my book on dinosaurs, I describe the bombardier beetle, little beetle, half an inch long beetle that doesn't breathe fire, but boy, he has some cannon there that he shoots out some hot aqueous vapors heated to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, hot as boiling water, containing an irritating chemical. And I'll tell you, When he lets go of that in the face of an enemy, they take off and go somewhere else. That little old bombardier beetle can do that. I certainly think it's possible that some of these dinosaurs that had hollow domes on the top of their head, twin channels going down to their mouth, nobody knows what they used that for. I think that possibly they were the dragons or leviathan described in the scriptures. I worked with a chemical at the Upjohn Company when I was there, and in one of my intermediates, when it would contact air, it would burst into flames spontaneously. All it had to do was contact the oxygen in the air, it would burst into flame. I'm just saying that it could have been a chemical or a mixture of chemicals. When sprayed out into the air, it would spontaneously ignite. And so that would be what we're talking about here. Well, what happened to dinosaurs? How come we don't have dinosaurs on the earth today? Well, there's all kinds of ideas have been suggested. One of the most popular ideas today among the evolutionists is that an asteroid struck the earth and flung so much dust around the earth that it just blacked out the earth. And as a result, almost all the plants died. So all the plant-eating dinosaurs died. The meat-eaters who ate the plant-eaters, they died. And that was goodbye, Charlie. They all died. That's one of the popular theories. And the trouble with that theory, among other things, if that was true, this would have been a horrible catastrophe, a worldwide catastrophe that killed every dinosaur from the North Pole to the South Pole, all around the world. It would be a horrible catastrophe. Then why didn't it kill all the birds? How did those little fluttery birds manage to survive? What about the little thin-skinned mammals? How come they survived? You see, it doesn't answer that question at all. We believe the dinosaurs became extinct following the flood. The Word of God, the Bible tells us, that two of every land-dwelling, air-breathing creature, God brought and placed on the ark. There's only about 20,000 species today. But dinosaurs were land-dwelling, air-breathing creatures, they must have been included. But they came out into a world that was very hostile, very different than the pre-flood world. You see, dinosaurs today could never live near the North Pole or near the South Pole. They could never survive in such a place like that. Obviously, the world was drastically different in the past because of the increased amount of water vapor in the atmosphere before the flood that came down as rain. Only a fraction of it has returned to the atmosphere today. And water vapor is a powerful absorber and retainer of solar heat. That would have given, if all of this is true, then the pre-flood world, the atmosphere would create a what we call a greenhouse effect and would give the world a worldwide mild climate. That's why the dinosaurs could exist in those places. Well, the flood then brought about many, many changes. And apparently, and that's all we can say, we weren't there to see what happened, the dinosaurs failed to repopulate the earth and simply died out. As is true of thousands of other species, as is true of species today, they're still becoming extinct. What we see, we don't see species coming into existence today. What do we see? We see species dying out and becoming extinct. Just the opposite of evolution. Well, we could say more, but my book on dinosaurs goes into all the details on this. But let's move on, because I do want to present two more areas of evidence, and I know those seats are getting hard and it's getting a little bit late, but we need to do this. I want to say a few words about human origins. The next slide. Oh, I forgot I had just another thing or two to show you. The marine reptiles, we just have their fossils. Well, we still have turtles, but we have fossils of marine reptiles. Evolutionists believe some land reptile evolved into a marine reptile. So feet and legs change into paddles. And look at this ichthyosaur. Very fish-like reptile. He wasn't a fish, he was a reptile. Why, if some land reptile evolved into these things, we'd have all kinds of transitional forms. Do you know not one? I have a book by evolutionists. Take the ichthyosaurs, for example. Say they appear fully formed. We don't have a clue where they came from. Well, I have a clue where they came from. But they didn't evolve from some land reptile. Every one of these creatures appear fully formed. No trace of ancestors. Next slide shows flying reptiles. These pictures are taken from my book on dinosaurs, by the way. They have these long fourth fingers to support the wing membrane. Incredible creatures. And evolutionists believe that these things evolved from land reptiles. Why? Just think about that. If his wings, about 25% wings, He couldn't fly, but he couldn't run any longer either, dragging those useful things around. It'd be a total unfit, you see, to survive. You know what? Every one of these flying reptiles or fossils appear fully formed. They're not a trace of an ancestor. Nothing to indicate that they evolved from anything. They all appear fully formed. Incredible evidence for creation. The next slide. Now, evolutionists believe that millions of years ago there was an ape-like creature. And some of these ape-like creatures evolved into the modern apes. Gorillas and chimpanzees and gibbons and so forth and so on. Some of these same creatures got over somewhere else and became isolated, and they evolved into people. So there was a split. And of course they believe that there must have been many intermediates going from the ape-like creature to man. Maybe 50, maybe 100, who knows how many intermediate stages there were. They're looking for fossil evidence of these intermediates. And from time to time, they've claimed they've found some evidence for the existence of these intermediates. I have time to discuss only one this evening. Now, in my book, Evolution, the Fossils Still Say No. You see, my original publication is called Evolution, the Fossils Say No. This was a later edition published in 1995, Evolution, the Fossils Still Say No. I have a complete chapter in that book on the origin of man. But I'm going to talk about only one of these suggested intermediates tonight, called Australopithecus. Australopithecus means southern ape. Fossils were first discovered in South Africa. The next slide. Other fossils have been found in other places around Africa. This is the skull discovered by Dr. Louis Leakey and his wife Mary in East Africa in 1959. You see, it's grossly ape-like. It had the sagittal crest, that is the bony ridge on the top of the skull, is typical of apes. Had no forehead, the skull was flat, massive eyebrow ridges, other features of apes. The brain was about one-third of the human, but it was claimed that the teeth were rather human-like, indicating that this creature was on its way to becoming people. Now, later, in the 1970s, Donald Johanss, an American paleontologist, found fossils of similar creatures in Ethiopia. He named them Australopithecus afarensis. One of them was of a female, about 40% complete. He called her Lucy. And although Lucy, as we'll see from the neck up, was essentially an ape, he claimed that she and her fellow creatures walked upright, just like you and me. Therefore, this was a transitional form between ape and man. And, of course, the mass media and the evolutionary world all flocked in and accepted it. And overnight, this obscure paleoanthropologist became world famous, along with Lucy. Next slide. Ladies and gentlemen, please meet Lucy. This is Lucy. And later on, they discovered enough material to reconstruct a skull for these creatures. The next slide. We see the skull of Australopithecus afarensis. What are you looking at? Well, it certainly looks like an ape, doesn't it? It had the jaws, the teeth, and the face of an ape. And the brain was about 30% of the human. Whatever else you could say about this thing, from the neck up, certainly was an ape. But it was claimed that they walked upright. Therefore, they were intermediate. And you know that's what we find in our textbooks used in our public schools. That's what we see in National Geographic, what we see on television. This is what we read all the time. But you know there are some scientists who don't believe that. These scientists are not creationists, they are evolutionists. And all they have certainly done their homework. One of these scientists was Lord Zuckerman, Dr. Solly Zuckerman, for many years the head of the Department of Anatomy, University of Birmingham in England. He was first knighted and became Sir Solly Zuckerman. Later, the British government raised him to the peerage and he received the title of Lord Zuckerman in recognition of a distinguished scientific career. Lord Zuckerman had a scientific team that rarely numbered less than four that studied the fossils of these creatures for 20 years, or 15 years, using the most sophisticated methods of anatomy available. After these many years of research, Lord Zuckerman and his scientific team declared these creatures did not walk upright. They were not intermediate between ape and man. Dr. Charles Oxnard, one of his former students, was head of the Department of Anatomy, director of graduate studies at the University of Southern California Medical School. He's now at the University of Western Australia. This scientist studied the foot bone, the leg bone, the knee joint, and the pelvis of these creatures. And after these many years of very careful, sophisticated research, Dr. Oxnard declared these creatures did not walk upright, certainly not in that human manner. They were not intermediate to an ape and man, and he said they were not human ancestors. Now, these are the people that have done the research. They have done the careful research. They are evolutionists. They have not any bias towards the creationist point of view, and they claim these things certainly are not related to human at all. Now, but could all those other scientists be wrong? Well, Lord Zuckerman said this. He said, first of all, he didn't think there was any science in this field at all. If people so eager to, you know, to find something. So he said there's no science in this field at all. Now, why would he say that? Well, let me give you a few examples. The next slide, please. This is a picture I took in the San Diego Museum of Man about 20, 25 years ago of a creature called Ramapithecus. Now, this is their model of this creature, Ramapithecus. And, of course, they believed he was intermediate. Now, supposing you were there in that museum at that time, when you look at this creature, what would you say? There is living proof of evolution. How could you deny the fact of evolution when you look at that creature? He was not a man. He was not an ape. He was intermediate and walking erect, just like you and me. Now, you would not know that at that time, all they had of this creature was a few pieces of the jaw and a few teeth, and that's all. And that's what they got from that scanty evidence with their preconceived notions. Well, since that time, they found much additional material of the face and so forth, and so it's allowed a much more accurate reconstruction. Next slide. This is a present-day reconstruction of Ramapithecus. This is the skull of an orangutan, a modern ape. Look at that fossil compared to the living orangutan. It's the same. Now, these scientists who were declaring 20 and 25 years ago that Ramapithecus was intermediate between ape and man said, no, we were wrong. We were misled by our preconceived ideas. He was essentially the same as a modern orangutan, a modern ape. You want to know what Ramapithecus really looked like? Next slide, please. That's what he looked like. That's an orangutan. Quite a difference, isn't it? Quite a difference. Yep. Quite a difference. Next slide. And then we have Piltdown Man. This is a picture I took from a 1937 issue of Life magazine. Piltdown Man was reconstructed from fossils found in some gravel near Piltdown, England, including a jawbone and a skull. The jawbone was quite ape-like, but the teeth appeared to be man-like. The skull was quite human-like. They put them all together in a single individual and named him Eanthropus, or Don Man. And he became known as Piltdown Man. And the consensus of the world's greatest authorities, Piltdown Man was our subhuman ancestor. Until the 1950s, when he's shown to be a fake, a hoax. Someone had taken a jawbone of a modern ape, a human skull, had treated them with chemicals to make them look old, altered the teeth to make them look human-like, planted the bones in the gravel and fooled the world's greatest authorities. And it's amazing how many ape-like characteristics those experts could see in that human skull and how many human-like characteristics those experts could see in that modern ape skull. They were not there at all. Now we say, I will believe it when I see it. They saw it because they believed it. See, they were misled by their preconceived ideas. 1922, one tooth, one single tooth was found in western Nebraska. Created a great deal of excitement among evolutionists because they thought in that tooth they could see characteristics between intermediate between ape and man. And they weren't quite sure was an ape-like man or man-like ape. And it became known as Nebraska Man. 1922, the Illustrated London News published a picture of this so-called Nebraska Man based on its description of the scientists. We see that in the next slide. See what the headlines say? The earliest man tracked by a tooth, an astounding discovery of human remains in Pliocene strata. Sure enough, there's the man, there's his wife, and there's the tools they were using based upon one tooth. As Mark Twain once said, the science is a fascinating subject. You can get such a wholesale production of conjectures from such a trifling investment of facts. And this was a glaring example. Well, a few years later, they discovered some additional remains of this creature. He turned out to be neither a man-like ape or an ape-like man. He turned out to be a pig. That's right. All this was based upon a pig's tooth. Ladies and gentlemen, look what evolutionists can get from a pig's tooth. If you pardon me for saying so, this is the case when evolutionists made a man out of a pig. The pig made a monkey out of the evolutionist.